Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So do you relax by watching House or ER or Grey's Anatomy? I don't know how you do. I find all these shows incredibly anxiety-producing. But they are all set in hospitals, and they may be among the most popular television series these days. But obviously, we all dread spending any real time in a real hospital. Well, writer Julie Solomon spent a year following the goings-on at one of New York's hospitals, Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn. It's a private hospital and incredibly diverse. And her new book talks about that particular microcosm of America's healthcare system, but it's really by extension about all hospitals and the kinds of challenges that we as patients and that people who work there face in our healthcare system. So this book is really for and about everybody. The book is called Hospital: Man, Woman, Birth, Death, Infinity, Plus Red Tape, Bad Behavior, Money, God, and Diversity on Steroids. That's just the title. It's out from Penguin Press, and she joins me now. Hi, Julie. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Let me ask you one thing about the subtitle first. Man, Woman, Birth, Death, Infinity, with the symbols right on the cover. That's taken from a really old doctor show, isn't it?
It is. From Ben Casey.
Ben Casey. That was the one with Dr. Zorba.
Dr. Zorba.
The old guy. Played by...
Oh, God.
I'm trying to remember.
I can't remember either. I should know this.
Actor with a...
Okay, with the hair.
With the
Sam,
hair.
Sam... So,
somebody's going to write in
right
to our comments page at WNYC.org and remind us who that actor was. But did you make that reference on purpose? Was it a reference to that?
It was a reference to that. My daughter, who's now 18 years old, when she was very small, I'd wake up in the middle of the night for various reasons to feed her. And every time I'd turn the TV on, Ben Casey was on, so I watched many episodes half asleep. And, oh, wait, that's how the show began.
Man, Woman, Birth, Death, Infinity. Then you added, plus Red Tape, Bad Behavior, Money, God, and Diversity on Steroids. Now, you are perhaps best known for your book, The Devil's Candy, which maybe some of the listeners know. It's about the making of the movie Bonfire of the Vanities, from the Tom Wolfe book. And I noticed that this book opens with a list of the cast of 69 characters, and you call them characters, even though this is a nonfiction book, from hospital administration, the staff, and the community. Did you find similarities between hospitals and movie making?
Well, I think at certain levels there are a lot of similarities. In fact, the chairman of the hospital, Marty Payson, who used to be a movie executive, said, you know, you have your big egos, your talent, the high-priced surgeons, you've got your feuding, but there's one major difference. In a movie, you're making a movie. In a hospital, it's life and death.
That's right. Sam Jaffe, by the way.
Sam Jaffe, very good.
Great, Dr. Zorba. And you also wrote a book about the man, the actual historical Maimonides.
That's right.
Who gave this hospital its name? Is that a coincidence?
Not at all. I came to the hospital. I wrote a book called Rambam's Ladder. Rambam was Maimonides' nickname, Rabbi Moses ben Maimon. And after that book came out, several different people, won't go into the whole long story, but who were either affiliated with Maimonides or going to Maimonides, called me up and wanted to talk to me about this hospital, which was named for Maimonides, who, in addition to being a philosopher, was a physician. And the more I found out about it, the more I wanted to go see what it was about.
And this hospital is in Borough Park, founded originally to serve the Orthodox Jewish community there?
Well, it was originally founded to serve the immigrant Jewish population, which 100 years ago wasn't necessarily Orthodox.
It's that old. It's a 100-year-old hospital.
Yeah, 100-year-old hospital. And then the neighborhood became increasingly Hasidic, very Orthodox, and then it became extremely multicultural. I mean, Borough Park itself is a very Orthodox community, but the zip codes that the hospital serves is everything, and their motto is 67 languages spoken here, sometimes more.
Do they really speak the 67 languages? Do they have that many translators?
They do. I mean, many of the translators are the people who work in the hospital. One of the things I got from the patient rep office is this huge book, and it's everybody who's volunteered to be a translator, and it can be everybody from people working in the blood bank, nurses, technicians, and then I swear half the languages I absolutely had no idea what they were.
So I actually want to do two call-ins while
sure.
you're here. The first one right now for immigrants who have had any kind of experience of cultural problems, whether it's language or anything else, that you think may have affected the treatment, the quality of care, negative health outcomes for you or a loved one in any hospital or health institution, anywhere. Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, if you think you've had such an experience or if someone you know has. 212-433-9692. And, of course, how could it be fixed so that doesn't happen to somebody else? 212-433-9692. Or WNYC.org to post your comment on the Brian Lehrer Show page. If you are an immigrant or know an immigrant who has had a cross-cultural problem at a hospital. And then later we'll have a call-in with Judy Solomon for people who work in hospitals with your advice for getting the most out of them, because we know that everybody needs an advocate in the hospital these days to avoid horrible things from happening, not to mention get the best care. So we will ask you to be everybody's surrogate advocates right now if you work in a hospital and share your tips coming up in a little later, in a little while. But Julie, Maimonides is a big deal to Brooklyn, right? Marty Markowitz, the borough president, is one of your, quote, characters. He happened to be in the hospital for a stent one of the times you were there, and you have a cute vignette on the healing properties of journalists for politicians.
Well, it was very funny. I mean, Marty Markowitz had arrived at the hospital, and despite HIPAA, which is supposed to protect patients' privacies, I happened to have been at the Maimonides Board of Directors meeting that evening, and the president of the hospital got up and announced, Marty Markowitz is a patient here. Then she was quick to say, it's been all over the internet, so she wasn't violating HIPAA. So afterwards, she went down.
And now it's in your book.
And now
it's in my
book.
The whole world knows Marty Markowitz has a stent.
He has a stent. But this was before the stint. He was just in the hospital. Uh-huh. I mean, he was really sick. He had just come in, and we went to see him, and he looked pretty gray. I mean, he was not feeling very well and sitting there talking and very weak and very, you know, in the ICU. And then Pam Breyer, the hospital president, introduced me, and he said, well, what do you do here at the hospital? I said, well, I don't really work at the hospital. I'm a writer, and I'm writing a book. And all of a sudden, this man who was lying there half dead perks up, he sits up, and he starts talking about, Maimonides is the best hospital in Brooklyn. It's fabulous. He said, this isn't some outpost of a Manhattan hospital. This is the mothership. It's fantastic. The color came back into his cheeks. It was amazing.
You got to love Marty Markowitz for his Brooklyn pride, don't you?
You do. He's fantastic.
And you got to love politicians when they come upon somebody from the media. Oh, you're from the media. Ah, it's great. We're great. I love our brand. I'm going to run for mayor. Okay. Listeners, have you had an experience with the way cultural diversity affects health care? Russ in Westchester says he has. Hi, Russ. You're on the air.
Hi, Brian. Just want to let you know I love your show.
Thank
and,
you.
Particularly with this experience with the cultural, with the health care. So I had my daughter born last year in August 25th, and we used to go to a doctor and to ultrasound.
Right.
And basically, the problem was that he thought that we do not speak English in good level. So as you see, you know, I could speak and I could understand everything basically, but the problem was that he was speaking to us like he was speaking to people who do not understand it, and sometimes it was really weird, and I didn't find it correct from his point. But we left that doctor and went to another one. He was an Iranian doctor, actually. He was OB-GYN.
Uh-huh.
And actually, we had no problem with him because I think he understood everything in terms of cultural experience. And also, he knew that immigrants who come to this country have a little difference with the medical I guess, our health care. Because let's say, just for example, that back home, we have a tuberculosis shot when kids get born, so they get this from the early age, and when you come to this country, it gets a problem. And when you have your wife pregnant and she's ready to give a birth, it gets a problem too. And people do not understand over here that it's not such of a problem, but basically, I guess it's a medical technicality,
yes.
I guess.
Russ, when you were with the first doctor, did you feel like he was speaking to you as a child, as if you were a child?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the way you feel, because I'm telling you, he was speaking like to a person like who do not understand English. First of all,
Russ, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. Julie, is that reminiscent of things you've heard around Maimonides?
Yeah, and I think it becomes very complicated. One of the doctors who was in charge of the ER, which is an incredibly busy ER at Maimonides, and he told the residents there that when you have somebody coming in from another culture, the risk factor, you should treat it as a risk factor, as any other kind of medical risk factor, because you may not understand exactly what the patient, you may understand the words, but you may not understand the meaning. So cultural competency, which is what it's called in the medical field, isn't simply a matter of understanding the words. It's also understanding attitudes, fears, different ways of thinking about illness. It's really, so when you take a medical history of somebody from another country or another culture, you have to be ultra sensitive to make sure that you're talking not just the same language in terms of translation of words, but in translation of feelings and understandings.
Julie Solomon is my guest on WNYC, journalist and culture critic and author now of Hospital, Man, Woman, Birth, Death, Infinity, plus Red Tape, Bad Behavior, Money, God, and Diversity on Steroids, all about Maimonides Hospital and the community surrounding it in Brooklyn. And here's Mimi in Brooklyn, who says you did not have a cross-cultural problem at Maimonides. Is that right, Mimi?
No, it was a great experience. They have a great hospice program there. And my father, who was Muslim, was there for a pretty long time, and the rabbi would check in on him all the time and try to find an imam for him, was very concerned about that, and it was just a great experience. They were very, very thoughtful.
Thank you very much for that.
One thing that Mimi brings up, which I think is really great at Maimonides, because of the numerous backgrounds of different people, they have a fantastic patient rep department. I think they have about 30 people whose job is to help people find interpreters, to help people find an imam if they needed a priest, a rabbi, to sort of be an advocate for the patient. And I think it would be great. That's a great example, I think, for many hospitals to have people on staff who aren't necessarily medical people, but who can be there to represent the patient's needs.
The part of your subtitle that says diversity on steroids, from the fact that no one can pronounce the name of Maimonides Hospital unless they have prior knowledge, to the color of the blankets. What's the blankets thing?
Well, the blankets thing was that in the emergency room, the blankets were white originally, and then they found out that a lot of people from the Chinese community had associated white as the color of death. So they changed the blankets to make them beige. Then I got an email through my website from somebody who said, that's absolutely true. He says, and you know, in China, the blankets are white. So I don't know what that says about the medical care.
Huh. So we're going to turn the page here and take a break. When we come back, you're going to read a segment that you've agreed to read from the book. And we're really going to start getting into the hospital politics that you report on. And this is where we're going to open the phones for a second group of callers, and that is healthcare providers who work in any hospital, doctors, nurses. What advice do you give your loved ones about dealing with hospitalization? Is there a time of the year to avoid hospitalization at all costs? Maybe any national holiday? What if you find yourself parked in a hallway for days? We'll hear a story of somebody who went to the bathroom and found that she lost her bed because of overcrowding. Do you write on the part of your body to be operated on with a Sharpie? Call us and share your hospital-based advice at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, as we continue with Julie Solomon, author of Hospital. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, thanks for listening today. And some of you may be interested in my Wednesday night television show where web video meets the issues. Tonight we will play a clip that's making the rounds on YouTube where John McCain met Ellen DeGeneres. Strange Bedfellows, we'll show that among many other things tonight at 7:30 on CUNY TV, Channel 75. We continue now with author and culture critic Julie Solomon, her new book, Hospital, all about life at Maimonides Hospital in Brooklyn, in Borough Park. You had incredible access, right?
I did. Incredible.
The president of the hospital on down.
They let me in. I mean, part of what my luck was is that they were sort of in between PR people, so there was a little gap that I kind of came through.
And you're going to read a passage from the book about tensions between some of the actors at the hospital. Do you want to set it up or just read?
I think it speaks for itself. Every day at Maimonides, I was reminded that the healthcare system wasn't anonymous or abstract. It was the sum of individual human successes and failures, each of which could build or destroy. Most people didn't set out to screw things up. They just didn't take the time to remember to learn the legacy of the man whose name the hospital carried, Maimonides, the philosopher and physician. The hospital was populated by humans, imperfect men and women, existing in an imperfect world. Politicians started out believing in the social contract and then forgot their duty to fight for the people they represented. Drug and insurance executives said their desire was to improve and protect health care, but their jobs and fortunes depended on profitability, not making medicine available to everyone. Technocrats worshipped faster and more efficient machines that helped prolong health and life, but they neglected empathy, understanding, and the probing that requires genuine conversation and time. Doctors planned to devote their lives to healing and then spent too much time analyzing their bank accounts or nursing bruised egos instead of making sure the system provided for their patients. Patients agreed with all of the above, but failed to accept responsibility for the abuses they inflicted on themselves by working too hard, exercising too little, and smoking, drinking, and eating too much.
Mm. So that's a tough starting point for any medical system, but ours with its particular complexities that I think are caught in a nutshell there. So given those tensions, how do they do?
You know, they do better than I thought they would. You know, at the beginning, I think the book kind of reflects my own journey through this. At the beginning, I think a lot of the internal feuding and wrangling and kind of tension that I felt in the hospital among the workers was surprising to me, maybe from watching House or any of these shows where people sort of resolve their differences every 45 minutes or so. And yet, I think and the pressure is enormous, the money pressure to get patients through the system. You know, the hospital head of accounting said she used to deal with 4 or 5 insurance companies. Now it's 21 or 22, all with different regulations. You see nurses who used to be at the bedside now in front of computer screens trying to figure out how to discharge patients quicker so the hospital gets paid more. Mm. Or enough, I should say. Mm-hmm. And so, needless to say, this puts a lot of pressure on everybody not connected to the healing process. And yet, I would say in the end, I was really amazed over and over again at how much people actually cared.
So is there a bad guy? Your subtitle includes red tape, bad behavior, money in that order next to each other. Is there a bad guy?
You know, sometimes the good guys were the bad guys. You know, you'd find a doctor who could be a complete jerk, you know, worrying about his turf, you know, trying to steal time and money and patients away from another doctor. And then you'd see that same doctor being really kind, being a good doctor, being a great surgeon. And so the good guys and the bad guys depended on what hour of the day you might be talking to that person.
And to go back to the movie analogy that you mentioned at the beginning of the hour, the star doctor, the actors, the quote, talent, who are they?
Well, surgeons, far and above. You know, there was a surgeon at Maimonides who made $3 million a year. Now, the tech who hands that surgeon the equipment, and that tech better be doing a great job or the patient will get a secondary infection and die, that tech may be making $25,000. Mm. Big discrepancy. And that's, I think, another kind of cultural difference that people often don't think about in the hospital is that very few heads of major corporations work elbow to elbow with the person sweeping the floor. Whereas in hospitals, every single person at that hospital makes a difference in the health of patients.
I heard a story from a friend the other day about a hospital in Queens where they actually found feces out on one floor of the hospital, and the patient who I was being told about got an E. coli infection while she was in the hospital. Was it a coincidence? Who knows? But it goes right down to that very, very low-paid cleaning staff, at least potentially.
No, absolutely. In fact, there's been a big push now for hand washing. You know, you think, well, of course everybody washes their hands, but you know what? They don't. It's been a huge issue in the medical community altogether. And now Medicare has started linking payments to lower rates of infection. And now people have started washing their hands more frequently.
Linking payment to lower rates of infection?
Yeah. So you get a higher the better your hospital performs, the more they'll get reimbursed.
And it's improving things, right?
It is.
After all that publicity about MRSA and stuff a few years ago?
It does improve things. I mean, sadly, the bottom line counts. It's always follow the money.
The New York Post read an article about the severe overcrowding in the hospital emergency rooms in our area the other day. One woman at Maimonides got out of her ER bed to go to the bathroom and lost her space, ending up in the hallway. I doubt that story surprised you.
No, not a bit. I mean, Maimonides, the guy who's the head of the ER chief, did this calculation of how crowded the emergency room is at Maimonides, and he said, you know, the average hospital, it's two patients per square foot per year. He said a crowded ER is 4 patients per square foot per year. At Maimonides, it's 6 patients per square foot per year. So it's 3 times as crowded as a normal hospital.
And that issue of getting people out of the ER and into a room might be a good place to talk about the enormity of the system's issues involved in running a hospital. What goes into finding a bed?
Well, what goes into finding a bed are numerous things. I mean, it seems, you know, one of the things that would happen at Maimonides, you know, the Orthodox community is very vigilant, and occasionally they'd have spies going through the hallways to see if there was an empty bed. And they'd find empty beds, and they'd say, if there's an empty bed, why is there a 12-hour or 15-hour wait in the emergency room? And so I met this woman called the bed manager, another nurse who's now doing a different kind of job than she was trained for. And her entire job is to find beds where they can match patients to beds. But it's not as simple as it might sound, because there may be an empty bed, but it may be that the patient in that room has some kind of disease that doesn't match the patient in the ER who needs a bed and might cause an infection. Or one may be a man, one may be a woman, simplest case. And there are all kinds of complications that patients don't see that prevents the backup. The other thing is Maimonides, any hotel would like to have their occupancy rate. The hospital's 98% full. So that's also a big problem.
Julie Solomon, my guest on WNYC, her book Hospital, in which she followed the goings-on at Maimonides Hospital for, what was it, a year?
A year.
And Julianne in Far Rockaway, who is an ER nurse. Hi, Julianne. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. I'm actually from Jamaica, and I'm a resident nurse in a emergency department. My advice is that it's beneficial to have someone with some medical knowledge to be with their loved one. And my reason for that is due to the shortage of nurses, it's close to being impossible to fully take care of the patients. And, of course, that could lead into patient becoming sick, like you said, with E. coli. That's very common.
Really?
And also possible death. And one of my example is yesterday I went to tell my mom in the hospital, and she receiving this potent medication that should be given in a particular amount of normal saline, and it was given this small amount of saline, and they was pretty much running the medication through gravity, which should be in a pump, and she felt she was going into shock. And the reason for that is they have inexperienced nurses who work in the ER because they can't afford to have experienced nurses there.
Right.
It's just really our situation.
Julianne, thank you very much for calling. And that's a good start, if a scary one, to this call-in segment with Julie Solomon on what advice you give your loved ones about dealing with the hospitals. If you are a doctor or a nurse or anyone who works in a hospital, Julianne's line is now free. All our others are full up. But what if you work in a hospital? What advice would you give all our listeners? They're all your loved ones if they go into a hospital. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Julie, any reaction to Julianne there?
Yes, I think what she was saying was extremely smart. The other thing that patients definitely should do is if you take a lot of medications or you take any medications, you should keep a typed list of them ready on your refrigerator. Not to say that you should always be ready to go to the ER, but you should. You should have a typed list of every medication that you take. And if you have any kind of chronic illness, have it there. So if, God forbid, you have to go to the ER, when the EMS people come, you say, there's this list on the magnet on my refrigerator. Mm-hmm. Bring it with me.
Right. Or medication allergies, too.
That's right. Allergies, medicine you take. Have a brief medical history but complete, typed up and ready to go, because the more information you have, the better the care will be.
Tony in Flushing, an ER doctor. Doctor, thanks for calling.
No problem. Thanks. I love your show.
Thank you.
My advice is actually pertinent now because we're approaching July 1st, which is the time when all of your new trainees enter medical postgraduate training. And it's notorious from an insider's perspective as the most dangerous time to be in the hospital, because brand new interns are learning their craft and beginning. So, of course, no one can choose when they get sick, but if you can at least get to maybe August or September, give people a chance to get their feet wet a little bit, I think people...
Do you think that's more true in the ER or throughout the hospital? So for people choosing elective surgery and a time to do it, for example?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think ER is probably where, you know, the most, you know, experience it comes into play in, you know, acute care medicine. So, yeah, probably more in the emergency department where, you know, you're more likely to be because of something emergent. But I think it actually, you know, it carries throughout the hospital.
Right. Tony, thank you for that. It is a good time, though, Julie, to go on jury duty. Because all the lawyers take vacations then, and you get dismissed very quickly. But you were giving me a knowing nod there during Tony's remarks.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, everybody says July, you know, it's not the normal school year, but it's the big turnover moment. And one of the doctors that I followed through the year was the true outsider at Maimonides. He was this young resident who had come there by accident. He'd pushed the M on the match and meant to go to Methodist, and he ended up at Maimonides. And he was this non-ethnic kid from Nebraska.
Oh, that got excerpted in the New York Times.
Yes, and he's just fantastic. But watching his development, in July he knew nothing. By October he knew a little bit. And by January, he was going, oh, I love working on Shabbos. He says it's when the Orthodox just go home early and it's not so busy.
Yeah, I went to Penn Station and wrote in NE because I wanted to go to the Northeast, but I wound up in Nebraska. Sarah in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for such a wonderful segment. I happen to be all for today, so I'm glad I'm listening.
Thank you. What do you do?
I'm a hospital administrator, and I am also on the diversity council at the institution I work in. So we've been working on, you know, a lot of these issues as well. But, you know, you're right that the hospitals are under a lot of pressure, financial pressure, which translates into sometimes the training that's provided to staff and the treatment that's given to patients. And the advice that I'd like to give is to patients and their families to read the patient's Bill of Rights, to read their HIPAA policies, and not to be afraid to complain, especially about your doctor. Because a lot of times we find that people will be upset about certain things, but when they get to see the doctor, they're afraid to complain about them.
Is it a double-edged sword, Sarah? Because on the one hand, obviously, you want to advocate and have a loved one there, preferably to advocate vigorously on your behalf. On the other hand, if they think they're a pain, that you're a pain in the you-know-what, then maybe they're going to treat you a little more shabbily.
I think that's the misconception, and I think that's why people just don't say anything. But what happens is when you do complain, and you have to make sure you complain not to the secretary, not to the person that's there taking care of you, but to the administration, even if it's after the fact. That way everyone is aware of it, the administration is aware of what the problems are, and then we can address them. And I've gotten...
How do you complain to the administration? Give me the nuts and bolts of that. If I'm in a hospital room and, you know, my wife is there advocating on my behalf, and the people we're coming in contact with are nurses and nurses' aides and physicians' assistants and once in a while an actual doctor.
Right.
How do we actually lodge that complaint with administration?
You start by asking who your supervisor is. And you ask, then you speak to that particular person. You ask that person who their manager is. There is literature all over the hospitals that are handouts that are sitting on desks where people can see who the administrative staff is, who the head of the emergency room is, who the head of surgery is, who the president of the hospital. Don't be afraid to go to the president of the hospital, who will now come down and bring that complaint down to the level where it's supposed to go. And when a president of a hospital receives a complaint from irate patients, they don't want to hear it.
Now, stay there, Sarah, because I'm going to put you on with James in Westport, who's a doctor and maybe has a little view of the same, a little different view of the same issue. James?
Okay. Oh, yeah. Hi, Leonard.
It's Brian. That's okay.
Oh, sorry. I'm an emergency physician in the New York area. I've been working for 15 years, and I have a slightly different angle on the conversation that we're having, and that is, sometimes I see families and loved ones actually getting in the way of care of the patient. I've seen it quite often, and it's not a bad thing to be involved and supportive of the patient and your loved one, but sometimes it's a good idea to let us do our jobs. And if you have a little patience and a little confidence that we will often surprise you and provide the care, you know, that the patient needs, and that the outcome will exceed the expectation.
So, Sarah, the hospital administration, are you identifying with this, or are you thinking James is too arrogant, or what are you thinking?
I think that, you know, there's obviously a place for everything, a time and place. So I absolutely agree. Yes, you have to let the doctors do their job, and you have to let the nurses do their job, and the family members cannot get in the way. But even if it's after the fact, if you identify that you're not getting the treatment that you deserve, as a family member, step aside, let the providers do what they need to do, but now you need to find out who do you go to so that this doesn't happen to someone else, so that if you have to be in that situation again in a hospital, it's addressed. And what I'm advocating is for people to really take control of their care, and to really be in charge of complaining if you see something is not right, that it was done incorrectly, or like Julie said earlier, there are some areas that are not clean. Go complain to someone and say, what's going on here?
And James, this works for you?
In general, it's a good idea to be informed, and I love when patients will provide a good history and medication list and have supportive family members. I have a number of examples where overprotective family members or other private medical professionals from outside the hospital have hindered care or actually reduced the level of care.
How? Give me one quick example.
We had a child who comes in with an acute appendicitis, 10-year-old, and the father, who was very overprotective, called a private doctor from another hospital. And he made another call, and he called a doctor on staff at our hospital who would ultimately see him. And the doctor came in and said, I want no one touching my son until this surgeon comes and sees him. Well, this was on a Sunday.
And the condition got worse because it wasn't treated.
And he would not let us take care of his son. The son was in pain. He wouldn't even let us intervene. Now, that's an extreme example, but I see this more frequently than people realize. It's sort of a protective stance, as if we, the medical community, are possibly going to harm the patient, when in actuality, if you stand back and let us do our job, you'll probably be pleasantly surprised. And I just want to address one other thing.
Real quick, do it in like 15 seconds if you can.
I will, I promise. That it's, feel free to also not just complain, but to compliment us. That's one thing that we frequently get. People are happy with their care. They, I guess it's human nature. We'll leave the hospital.
Take it as a given. It's true with so many people who work in all kinds of service industries. James and Sarah, thank you both for your openness on this. I really appreciate it.
No, you're welcome.
Thank
My
you.
Pleasure.
And Julie Solomon, we're going to give you the last word since you're the guest. That was pretty interesting, hearing the hospital administrator and the doctor.
Well, I think that one thing that's really, that I found quite interesting, in my year at Maimonides, the president of the hospital had instituted a training program for the surgical department called the Code of Mutual Respect. And at first I was pretty dubious about it, because it was sort of like, well, didn't you learn this in kindergarten? But it was basically to teach people interdepartmentally to behave nicer to each other. And I think listening to what the doctor was saying here on the radio, I think these basics of actually civil discourse could help a lot on both ends of the equation.
What do you hope comes of your book?
What I hope comes of my book, honestly, is that, you know, we talk a lot about the healthcare system, and it seems so big and so overwhelming that people throw up their hands and say, I don't understand what you're talking about. It's bad. I can't fix it. And what I think I saw in the hospital was all kinds of ways, small and large, that things were improving through systems changes, through behavioral changes. And I think that if I hate to say, I don't mean to sound like a Pollyanna, because I'm not, but I do think a lot of things can improve in our hospital system if people keep continuing what they're doing, which is to not shy away from these problems and to address them both on the hospital side and on the patient side.
Julie Solomon has written Hospital, Man, Woman, Birth, Death, Infinity, Plus Red Tape, Bad Behavior, Money, God, and Diversity on Steroids, published by the Penguin Press. You'll be doing a talk with Pam Breyer. Is she the
president of the hospital?
President of Maimonides Hospital, tonight at 6 at the Wagner School of Public Service at NYU. That's in the Puck Building, 295 Lafayette Street, on the second floor, and also a talk and book signing on Monday, June 2nd, 7:30 at Barnes & Noble, 106 Court Street in Brooklyn. This has been a fascinating conversation and interaction. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, look who's breaking with the president now. It's former White House spokesman Scott McClellan, who rips propaganda going into the Iraq war. Stay with us.